This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
I literally cannot count the number of times I have been asked about the question of hybrids. Are there alien-human hybrids? Is somebody changing us genetically right now, and has that happened in the past? Today on Dreamland, we're going deep into that territory and down that road in a totally incredible way. First, we're going to be talking to Bruce Fenton, the author, along with his wife, Daniela, who is also with us, about exogenesis, human hybrids. Has there been hybridization and genetic manipulation in the past? And is it happening now? Then, in the third half hour of the show, Daniela and I are going to be talking about direct experiences of this. Daniela has had a missing pregnancy that was confirmed in a doctor's office just like Anne's. Share something very profound here and be prepared for an intensely emotional experience during especially the last half hour of the show. Daniela just simply lays it out what is happening as relates to what happened to her. Bruce and Daniela, welcome to Dreamland.
Thank you very kindly for having me on.
Yes, thank you for having us on.
Yes. Well, okay. Well, let's get started. We'll later in the show, we're going to go into the past, because it could be that this is a designed species. There's a lot of evidence of that, and we'll explore that later on. But first, a considerable amount of information in here about TTSA, the Two Stars Academy, mention of Hal Pudoff, Louis Elizondo, and others. And I was very curious. You mentioned something that I have been aware of before, but that I hadn't really ever heard anyone talk about, and that is the degree to which the military brass view this through a religious lens. And I would like, if I could ask either one of you who is cognizant of this, what you know about this, because my findings are very disturbing, frankly.
Yes, I mean, this is, I think, is really an important and intriguing area of the of this TTSA / naval UFO topic that's become mainstream media news across the world, because it seems to be far less noted that at the early inception of that project, we had, I think it was particularly Louis Elizondo, the former senior person in the ATIP UFO research program, had highlighted that he had problems with senior staff in the Department of Defense who didn't really want this program to exist at all because of their suspicion that this was a religious issue and that the phenomena that they were encountering might fall under the category of angels and demons and was best left alone. But it wasn't only in the US, because Nick Pope, who was used to be kind of one of the heads of the UFO program in the British Ministry of Defense. He also has highlighted in a news story that there were similar feelings in the UK with, senior members of our defense infrastructure were also seeing this through a religious framework. And so that's quite a massive issue that hasn't really featured in a lot of these, these big title news articles that we've seen on UFOs. But there's not really a discussion on the religious implications, and there should be if our senior military, officials are actually viewing it that way.
Well, I know they are. It's not – I know it for certain, and I think it's appalling, and it's one of the major reasons for the secrecy. It's the reason that, for example, the Navy, which does not share this view with the Air Force, will – release material and talk about it and so on and so forth. The Air Force is absolutely silent, the U.S. Air Force, because any notice, they believe, of demons and demonic technology only encourages them and draws them closer. They are viewing this through the lens of ancient religious beliefs that date from thousands of years ago. Now, why would that be?
Well, I definitely think that there's an inherent aspect in terms of seeing things in the sky, that, you know, strange things in the sky. If we look at that in a kind of a biblical context, you know, it's hard not to connect to some of the phenomena that ancient people would have considered to be possibly angels, you know, these messengers of the divine. So I think there's it's kind of built into the Christian, not just the Christian system, but into the Abrahamic religions, the idea that, you know, there's angels in the sky, these strange phenomena. And they've gone through all kinds of descriptions in history, you know, obviously up to the point now where we usually think of winged beings, but that's not really how the origins of them are. We hear they're clouds, they are you know, strange geometric patterns, they're consciousness without bodies. So the definition of angel has modified a lot. So I think there's a lot of scope within that for a Christian to say, well, perhaps these too are, you know, biblical angels or biblical demons. So I do think it's to do with the vagueness perhaps of those designations in the religions.
No one in the Air Force and only one individual in TTSA will speak to me. After my old friend Peter Lavenda got involved with TTSA and writing Tom DeLonge's books as a sort of semi-recognized ghostwriter, in other words, his name is on the books, but the degree to which he wrote them, he told me, was he wrote everything. In any case, a year and a half ago, he suddenly stopped talking to me as well. And what worries me about this is that I have heard from friends in the Air Force, because I come from a family that's deeply connected to the Air Force, that I am thought of as being demonized. In other words, I am myself in league with demons. And I thought to myself when I heard this, could it be that a superstition that's thousands of years old could be behind policies of secrecy and denial? And I think, though it's true, I think that's exactly why. That, and plus the fact that the Air Force can't control the skies, and the abductions and so forth are coming from the skies.
Yes, and I think there's two things there I'd pick up on. One is that also, if we flash back a little bit further in time to Project Stargate, you know, the official, well, semi, it wasn't meant to be official, but the official remote viewing program at the, you know, the Pentagon and the DOD, which again, you know, Hal Putov and some of the other, you know, characters in this backstory have been involved with. That too, when it was finally exposed, you know, which was a kind of an accidental blunder with an interview being given, I think, by President Carter, and him referring to this finding a downed Russian plane or something using a psychic. And then it came out that there'd been this, you know, extensive remote viewing program for years and years and years. But then when that happened, when that came out, people missed this point as well, that there was a huge backlash within the structure of the government against it, not because so much because it sounded woo, but because these, again, people were saying this is playing with the forces that are demonic and that are magical, and that, you know, that we shouldn't be doing this on those religious grounds. So this isn't a new problem. We can see that any time that we delve into these areas where, you know, occult, mystical, or psychical, there is some extraordinary backlash, particularly with the more conservative right-wing Christians who, you know, make up a lot of, you know, I guess the senior areas of government, particularly
the
Air US.
Force in particular.
Yeah, and in the Air Force too. So this is not new. And the other problem we have, and you rightly said, is that we're also highlighting the fact that we can't really protect the skies. And that's something that's been missed in a lot of the press with the Navy UFO incident, this Nimitz carrier, is that the people on board have said that they were tracking these objects, a whole swarm of objects above the fleet, for several days. And yet the admiral and all these senior staff made no attempt to engage. You know, the official policy is hidden in plain sight, because clearly it's to ignore these things. Do not engage, because if they do, you show up the fact that you do not have supremacy in the air. And if you don't have supremacy there, really don't have any supremacy. It means that someone else has full spectrum dominance.
Yeah. And we have a situation where something that could be really useful to mankind, contact with whatever this is being suppressed, not by scientists or philosophers or people with any real insight into human culture, but by military officers who have, frankly, very primitive religious beliefs, which mm-hmm. they are applying to this, and which they are therefore keeping all of this secret. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that Harry Truman was told by I'm getting old, darn it. Anyway, let me do this again.
Okay.
I know that Harry Truman was told by the Air Force that they believed this to be a very evil, demonic presence. And he was also told that an invasion was imminent and we had to put up a show of resistance to let them know that we would not accept that. Thus, we started a shooting war with them. So, where are we with this now? I mean, TTSA seems to be making some headway in some respects. In other respects, it seems to be falling apart in a way. I've heard Tom DeLonge talking on the Joe Rogan show and saying all kinds of crazy things that don't bear any relationship to fact. And if you read the books, that's in them too.
Yes.
And so where are we here?
Yeah, this is a problem because I think that a lot of people had, you know, reasonably, I suppose, had high hopes with the project, you know, TTSA's project, the fact that you've got quite high level former, you know, DOD and military, you know, staff on board, as well as scientific researchers that know a lot about anomalous phenomena, everything from, you know, these psychic programs to the UFO topic. So there was a lot of reason for hope. But we also have to keep in mind that, yes, Tom has his own views, which incorporate a lot of stuff that is really far out, you know, the Antarctica secret bases. And I'm not saying that they couldn't be there, but the thing is, a lot of these things don't have the evidence to substantiate them in any way that you could really go to somebody and say, look, here's the evidence. And that, you know, it's talked about possible, you know, this war with bugs, some kind of, you know, specific alien species. There's a lot of talk about it being a, you know, threat narrative, that, you know, having to deal with a military threat from whoever these, you know, entities and forces are. Now, there's a question as to whether that is to do with needing to engage the DOD structure through the threat narrative, because, you know, the DOD deals with threats. So I can understand that there may be an argument to say they're just using that terminology to get interest. But of course, they may be furthering an agenda, which is this threat narrative, which has put humans off of encountering and dealing with, you know, consciousness that's non-human over the centuries. So it's really, to me, it's a bit unclear, but certainly, yeah, it seems to have crumbled apart a bit. There's no clear direction for them. The materials that they've been involved with haven't substantiated, you know, the presence of a physical craft from somewhere else. They've not shown the kind of capabilities that they hoped for or had promised. So there's a lot there, I think, to make people now quite skeptical of where that organization is going, although they can be hopeful that it's at least changed the media narrative a little bit. You know, there's some more serious talk of what are these objects in the sky. That's probably been the biggest positive out of it.
Well, let's hope that's true. Free Dreamlanders, we're going to take a little break now. So listen up and do everything that they tell you in the commercial.
Support UnknownCountry.com and its great mission to make contact happen. Use our vast archive of interviews, meditations, commentaries, news, and Whitley Strieber audiobooks to expand your mind and your understanding of close encounter. Meet others who have similar interests on our active free message board or in our subscriber comments and Wednesday night chats. There is no other site like Unknown Country in or out of this world. Go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe today.
Owls are somehow connected to UFOs. I don't say that lightly. After over a decade of obsessive investigation, I am convinced of this connection. As strange as it may seem, people are seeing owls in the highly charged moments of a UFO sighting, and within the challenging memories of UFO abduction. This mystery has been the focus of my research. My name is Mike Cleland, and I have explored these connections in my book, The Messengers. At its core, this book is simply a collection of stories, and each is a remarkable real-life experience. The Messengers is also my own story of how owls played a role in my life. It's an exploration into the deeply personal questions that arose from my own contact experiences. The Messengers is the first in a trilogy of books, and each volume explores a deeper aspect of the UFO mystery. All my books are available on Amazon in paperback, ebook, and very soon as audiobooks. Owls are somehow connected to UFOs. I don't say that lightly. After over a decade of obsessive investigation, I am convinced of this connection. As strange as it may seem, people are seeing owls in the highly charged moments of a UFO sighting, and within the challenging memories of UFO abduction. This mystery has been the focus of my research. My name is Mike Cleland, and I have explored these connections in my book, The Messengers. At its core, this book is simply a collection of stories, and each is a remarkable real-life experience. The Messengers is also my own story of how owls played a role in my life. It's an exploration into the deeply personal questions that arose from my own contact experiences. The Messengers is the first in a trilogy of books, and each volume explores a deeper aspect of the UFO mystery. All my books are available on Amazon in paperback, ebook, and very soon as audiobooks.
One of the things in your book that really surprised me, and it's got a lot of surprises in it, is your mention of a paper published in Acta Astronautica by two neuropsychologists from the University of Cadiz in Spain, which is a place where this whole business is studied at a very high level. I am aware of that. Can you tell us a little bit about the experiments they ran and what the outcome of those were?
Yes, I mean, I find that a really intriguing project that's been going on within that team at the university, which they've run several related studies. Now, what they did is they took a look at how scientists, particularly SETI scientists, you know, space scientists, might look for intelligence beyond Earth. Now, typically, that's involved looking for radio signals and all the rest of it. But what they wanted to find out about is more about the psychology that's involved. So they ran some experiments testing whether people would notice an anomaly within an image. Now, one of the main ones they used was a picture of essentially a gorilla hidden in a landscape, in a planetary landscape. And what they sort of found from this was, funny enough, that the kind of, you know, intellectual people that usually fall into these fields, that, you know, don't have so much the artistic side of the brain, you know, fully fired up, that they tend to miss the anomalies, and that it's the more, you know, open-minded artistic types that notice them. Now, that's kind of ironic, because most of the people that we have at the forefront of the search for, you know, extraterrestrial intelligence are specifically a type whose brain is more likely to ignore these anomalies. So they started finding a huge bias against detecting the very things these scientists are supposed to be looking for. So it's like we have the wrong, you know, in a way we have the wrong people in the job. And it's another study they've done. They had, this is a very recent one, they found what seems to be geometric patterns within a crater on the dwarf planet Ceres. And these were a triangle, a circle, and a square clustered together. And both humans looking at these pictures and an AI that had been trained to recognize geometry both detected this anomaly. Now, that's quite extraordinary. And I thought, you know, you should be thinking, okay, well, that should be a big deal. But instead, the SETI kind of scientists have said, well, all this does is question whether we can use AI So the default is always the, well, it just can't be anything.
Right.
Ergo, you know, ergo,
nothing to see here. I know I'm in a spaceship, but there's still nothing to see here.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what comes up. The default is that we must be wrong, or it's not there, or not even noticing it.
Yes. You know, we had lots of people up at our cabin when the visitors were coming there quite often. And there were many people who had encounters with them. We once had a group which included a scientist who was an absolute rock-ribbed denier of all of this. And we were sitting in the circle where that we had made a stone circle where I had originally been drawn up into the little trashy little room in the sky. So we were sitting in the circle meditating together, and suddenly a perfectly extraordinary shaft of golden light came directly down from above. It was in a little forest clearing, so it wasn't a shaft of sunlight, and it was beautiful, absolutely beautiful, in the middle of the circle, shining there. And we were all talking about it. And suddenly I said to him, I said, now what do you think? And he said, there's nothing there. I said, what do you mean there's nothing there? He said, I can see it. It's right here. I put my hand in it. I could actually, you could feel the presence of this light. I would say it was because it was a little warm or something. But he could not see it. He never saw it. And then the rest of the day, spent the day in an agonizing state of headache because his mind was pushing so hard to keep that vision out, because it would have destroyed his worldview entirely. Mm-hmm. And this is what they're doing. There's nothing to see here because they can't face the fact that their whole world implodes as soon as they admit that there's anything to this. Now, a little farther on, you talk about what I think may be the hidden reason, and this is not even a reason that's in their minds, I wouldn't think. You say, if an advanced alien race visited Earth in remote prehistory and decided to modify an organism, let's specifically suggest a hominin ancestor of ours, it might be hard for us to ever detect this occurrence. The reason for the difficulty is that DNA undergoes changes and mutations. Then you go on and you explain why it would be hard. Then you go on, however, advanced aliens wanted to leave a signature of their handiwork, a DNA calling card of sorts. They could certainly do this. Now, I want to talk about that. I want you to tell us what you've learned about that possible DNA calling card.
Sure. Yeah, this was one of the things I just prefaced that with a little bit as well, is that there has been, you know, mainstream scientists that have voiced the idea that we should be looking in DNA for a possible message, particularly there's a well-respected space scientist,
folks, we're having a name block seizure between the three of us today. We don't know why.
Sorry, Dr.
Just
Paul
suffice
Davies.
To say that there is a doctor out there, and if he manages to remember, I've had to stop the show earlier because I forgot Tom DeLong's name. So, you know, we're in a weird space right now, but that's okay. We accept that he's real. Go ahead. Tell us what he said.
Sure. Yeah, it's Dr. Paul Davies, and he's on the SETI Post-Detection Task Force. And he's suggested that we could look for, you know, modifications in DNA because they could potentially persist for millions of years. Now, there's a specific type of an area of DNA where that can be, and that's in what's called non-coding areas, particularly highly conserved areas, which means that they very rarely, if ever, change due to random mutations. Usually they're so important to the functioning of an organism that if they change, you know, a million times, you know, out of a million one, you know, it will lead to the death of the organism. So perhaps you wouldn't have any lungs, or, you know, something like that. It's something so catastrophic that it rarely ever changes. Now, that's been highlighted as where we should look, because anywhere else in the genome, random mutations would eventually remove this signature or message or any evidence of engineering. So it's funny that just in the last few years, scientists have found that in these very same highly conserved non-coding areas, there are extensive accelerated mutations that are most of which are linked to the brain development in humans, which again is not very random, because we think about the idea of random mutation. If something like half of these are to do with the brain, that stops sounding random immediately. And you also, just to do a contrast for people, that they looked at chimpanzees, chickens, and humans in reference to one of these specific areas called HAR1. And what they found was that between the chicken and the chimpanzee, there was three DNA letters had changed in 300 million years of separate evolution. Then they looked at the human and the chimp, which have supposedly been separate for around 5 million years. And all the models predicted, of course, there'd be no differences. And what they instead found was that 18 letters had changed. And they said that when they ran the numbers for this, it came up as there was basically a 0% chance by any understood evolutionary mechanism that this should have happened. Right. So this is the kind of anomalies that I'm highlighting, that they're really extraordinary.
Well, this is extraordinary. This is a signature of something having been done to our DNA.
Yes.
Is there any timeline on these changes?
The bulk of them we know have occurred somewhat before the divergence, the split of Neanderthals and Denisovans and us, so in what they call the archaic humans, because we know that they were in all those lineages, and all the rest have happened in between the kind of the divergence from early primates. So there's some evidence there of an ongoing process of some manipulations going from the time of when we first split. In fact, you could say, what made us split? You know, was it this meddling in the first place? But then later on, there seems to be a cluster around the time that we become large-brained humans. And remember, Denisovans and Neanderthals are also large-brained, intelligent humans. They're not, we know today that they had art and they had tools and they had all these other things, you know, where we used to think of them as, right, as brutes and stuff, but that's been dismissed. So we know something happens just before that split, and it gives rise to this complex neurology that we all have. And it seems that a lot of these anomalies actually are to do with fetal brain development. In fact, most of the ones that they've unraveled so far are to do with that, but also to do with things like the opposable thumbs and, you know, the immune system, our reproductive system, things that are really crucial that if you were going to create a new organism, you know, those are the kind of systems you want to get at. And that's, funnily enough, where these anomalies are.
Yeah. And yet the scientific community doesn't address this. And I think doesn't really address it as what it probably is. Mm-hmm. I think that perhaps that's a cultural thing. In other words, if you said this might be true, the whole scientific culture would come after you. You could be, you have your career destroyed.
Yes. And also there's a tendency to link this with, again, with religion, because, as you know, we have a fairly well-funded and well-supported intelligent design movement, right? So whenever someone hears that you're talking about humans being created, you know, the default usually is, you know, we're dealing with religious, you know, Christian creationism, right? But funny enough, the evidence they're using in creationism, a lot of this would better support some kind of, you know, non-deity that has come in and has made modifications. Because apart from anything else, we are not perfect. I mean, look at all the genetic conditions that we have, right? Look at all the medical problems that are inherent in humans. Does it strike you as that, if this is a modification, that it's done by a perfect God that makes no mistakes? I mean, that's a problem.
Here's a thought. We had some evidence of the presence of visitors in our world for many years, for many generations. And Jacques Vallée talks about this, and you make reference to it in your book. But then suddenly, after 50 years of upheaval that ended with nuclear attack on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, this presence seems to have ramped itself up. In 1935, they were unheard of. In 2020, they're all over the place. And I will be talking to Daniela in a few minutes, and she's going to tell us about her experiences with them. And I'm a person who's – I'm doing this. I'm here because they put me here. They put me here by taking me out of my house in the middle of the night and abducting me. And I won't put it – I won't let it go. I'm never going to let it go because it was extraordinary. In other words, they've ramped everything up. And is it because they have realized there's a design flaw?
I think it's twofold. I think that it's to do with them understanding there's something inherently wrong within our species, as you highlight there. And I think that they're aware that there's things we need to correct, both psychologically, spiritually and genetically. I think there are errors. There's, they're causing problems here, but also the ecological crisis. And I know that you speak to that quite a lot yourself as well, that, we've got to a kind of a crossroads, where if we don't make some correct choices quite fast, we could end up in we are ending up already towards a terrible situation. So I think those two different issues are coming together, that they're aware there's things we need to address both as a species, but also in terms of our behavior and the planet. And so we're really at a crucial moment.
Well, we are, because we have a situation here where this pandemic is changing human society. But there are other things that you mentioned that have sort of taken a back seat to the pandemic. You don't really talk about it because I guess the book was written before the pandemic started. And understandably, you don't talk about it because you're not future casters or whatever. But you talk about another thing that is going on now and is intensifying, and that is the sun and the fact that we're in a period of quiet sun and that is beginning to look like the beginnings of another Maunder minimum, that is to say, another period which greatly decreased the temperatures on Earth. Can you tell us about that? And we're going to talk again in a moment about two other things. I'm not finished yet. This planet is headed for high strangeness for sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, the sun issue is, for me, is a major part of this story, and it's something that the global population will become more aware of, because we've had over the last two solar cycles, we have a solar cycle that's 11 years long, in the midway it has a peak and then it goes down to a lull where we have very few sunspots and much less energy activity on the surface of the sun. Now, in the last cycle, we had a very weak maximum with very few sunspots, and we had a very deep minimum with, I think it was a year with 75% clear surface of the sun. It was a really weak minimum. And again, it's looking like this is going to be the second weakest solar cycle compared to the last one. So that's why they're now talking about this being an obvious, a deep solar minimum and going into a real lull that could be like the Maunder minimum. And we have that happening alongside something that is perhaps missed, which is ancient predictions and prophecies and stuff that talk about this time being the end of the 20, which culture you look up is essentially the end of the fifth sun, and that we will have a rebirth of the sun and into a new, era of the sixth sun. This is the most common from the Mesoamerican cultures, right? But isn't it funny that they're talking about it in terms of suns, and here we are with the sun having this bizarre behavior right on this moment that they have predicted. They said, in 2012, there would be essentially, if you look at the Toltec, so there's a 9-year period between suns, the death of the energy of the last era around 2012. And then 9 years later into 2021, look, we're right there nearly, that we will be really stepping into the energy of the new sun. But it's physically happening above us. This isn't just a metaphysical concept, because we can literally see that something has gone, very strange with solar dynamics. And you can read, science magazines have been looking at this for the last few years. They've come up with various topics saying, there's something very wrong with our sun. They're detecting all kinds of new phenomena there. Something very strange is happening. And this is something I think everyone needs to get more aware of and look into it. I'm not, making it up. They can have a look into this themselves.
Yeah, I know you're not making it up. Believe me, I follow these things. Free Dreamlanders, you follow these things. Listen up.
Unknown Country and Dreamland are unique in every way. The site offers over 16,000 news stories dating back 20 years, all of them with our uniquely open-minded and yet carefully researched point of view. You can find stories of everything from lost cities to multiple witness high strangeness events to the cutting edge of science and reality on the site. For subscribers, the site offers a wealth of material that is mind-opening and can be life-changing. Plus, there are active comment sections, both in the free area and the subscriber area, and a free weekly newsletter. Dreamland, which Whitley Strieber has been hosting for over 20 years, is archived on the site back to 2004. This archive is the only one of its kind in the world, an incredible richness of information that offers exciting adventure every time you dig in. So go to unknowncountry.com daily, get our newsletter, participate in the site's social groups, and above all, subscribe and join this unique community today. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the subscribe tab to see our options.
This is Whitley Strieber. This is a Dreamland special event. In a few moments, you're going to be hearing an extraordinary interview. Linda Howell is interviewing Gary McKinnon. Gary McKinnon is about to be extradited in all probability to the United States to face charges for allegedly hacking into U.S. Defense Department and NASA computer systems in search of UFO information. Mr. McKinnon is a British citizen and has been fighting extradition, preferring to be tried in courts in his own country.
There follows a truly extraordinary interview between Linda Moulton Howe and Gary McKinnon, one of the few. Gary McKinnon was the young Britisher who hacked into NASA's computer system and found all kinds of very unusual material about space forces and all sorts of things. Well, now in 2020, the Space Force is going public. So was it really there all along? One of the few places you can hear an interview like this is on unknowncountry.com. This is one of the most extraordinary places in the world, and you really should get into it. Subscribe to unknowncountry.com today. You can listen to Gary McKinnon speaking very frankly about what he found, and there is so much more on this website. It is literally a treasure trove. Go to unknowncountry.com right now, click on the subscribe tab, and get started. There is real wonder waiting for you. We're talking to Bruce and Daniela Fenton. Their new book, Exogenesis, Hybrid Humans, A Scientific History of Extraterrestrial Genetic Manipulation. Now, I would like to go on a little bit about changes that are happening now because they're coming thick and fast. Another area of change is the magnetic field of the planet. And as we speak, there's a magnetic anomaly which is increasing in intensity and beginning to break into two parts across the Southern Ocean and the tip of South Africa. And if the magnetic field goes into chaos, we're in trouble. We're in deep, deep trouble. And it looks like as if that will happen. Now, you've mentioned it happened in the past, and you've speculated about what might have occurred, what might have happened to human beings then. Can you push that into the future? What if it happens starting 2 years from now? What happens to us?
Yeah, so it's going to be, particularly in our technological age, it gives us a number of problems. I mean, we do know that without the normal defenses of the shield, you know, which essentially acts as a shield against cosmic radiation and stuff. So without that we're going to have more cosmic energy reaching the surface, and that can impact, you know, organisms, you know, biological growth of plants and trees, but also health, you know, more cancers, other, you know, issues with DNA damage and mutations. Right? Those are real problems that we can have. In terms of our technology, you know, you'll have satellites being affected, bombarded with energy. Also, even already in the areas where the weakening has occurred, you know, they're talking about damage to satellites and spacecraft that go through that anomaly. So, and that's with just one small area. So let's imagine weakening is occurring, you know, fairly universally across the planet's fields. That will really cause some chaos because we rely on, you know, these satellites for all kinds of purposes, obviously for communications and you know, some more nefarious things, spying and all sorts. But there's, you know, there's a wealth of reasons why that would cause us huge problems. And then if we have a solar outburst during that time, you know, a major eruption of the sun and the energy were to hit us, we would essentially have our shields down. And this is a problem. If we're in a kind of early stages of reversal and a continued weakening of the Earth's field, you know, we can be impacted with a strong flare. And it would have far more devastating consequences than normal, you know, wiping out grids, destroying the transformers in the power system, which are totally destroyed just to, you know, manufacture more. And if the factories are offline, how do you manufacture them? So you can end up in a sort of cascading problem.
You know, years ago, I wrote a little short book called Solar Flares that was only published as an ebook. Mm-hmm. And at that time, there was a study I forget which federal department made the study, that if this happened, that the population of the United States would, over the next 10 years, decline by 90%. Mm. The reason being that the United States, in its wisdom, has not required its power companies to shield the huge transformers or to build additional huge transformers. There are about 90 of them, if I'm not correct, in the country that everything depends on. And if they were blown out, it would take years and years to replace them. The UK has not been so derelict. Yours are protected. So you could end up in a situation where the United States is essentially ceasing to exist and the UK is still intact. Will you come help us? You think?
Yeah, that could be kind of a strange situation where you could have whole countries reduced to being essentially living, I guess, towards what the Amish, you know, are living like today. You know, if people can imagine that suddenly you're going to be with horse and carts and trading, you know, and farming and candles. Things that, yeah, have the candles out at night. Whilst, yeah, on the other side of the world, that other countries could be carrying on, you know, almost right. As normal, you know. So extraordinary. But even with help from abroad, as you know, it would take a long time to rebuild these networks. And in the meanwhile, the chaos would be so overwhelming that, you know, what would be left by the time any new transformers were shipped? You know,
it would be too late. It'll be too late in a year. It'll be too late in 6 months. But this could go on for years and years if this happened.
Yeah. I mean, I think some people would probably escape, you know, to other countries. But if much of the world is impacted, you know, the fact that a few countries might have a grid that's still working, all that would really do is encourage some kind of, you know, invasions or something. Because I don't see how it's not enough support to be able to rebuild the world quickly. You know, have we look at such a scenario, it would prompt a good degree of chaos. You know, so people would have to be relying on themselves. You know, you couldn't be waiting for anyone to really save you. You know, you'd need to be able to become self-sufficient very quickly. And perhaps in the longer term, then, yes, you know, a global effort to rebuild could be made. But even then, we have to ask, do we rebuild a system that was broken, that was leading us into an ecological disaster? I mean, there's all these big question marks, isn't there, that what do you rebuild it into?
Now, I want to circle back again. Where we're going, folks, we're going to the abductions. And Daniela will chime in at that point because we're looking – basically, something I said in the foreword to a book by Jacques Vallée a few years ago, probably more than a few years ago, knowing me, it's 25 years ago or something, feels like yesterday. I said in the foreword that this is what the force of evolution looks like when it's applied to a conscious mind. I think we are having an experience of being altered right now. But to look at that through the lens that you provide in the book, which is quite a wonderful book, let's circle back to DNA and to the mutations that in this, as you put it in the book, here we are with 18 successful mutations in a fraction of a vast time scale, some arising just in the last few hundred thousand years. And then you mention a biostatistician says, the fact that HAR1 was essentially frozen in time through hundreds of millions of years indicates that it does something very important, that it then underwent abrupt revision in human beings, suggests that this function was significantly modified in our lineage. Mm-hmm. When did this happen?
Yeah, so some of these, they are struggling to get specific dates, but the majority do seem to appear between the time of the split with chimps, so 7 million years ago, and this split with Neanderthals and Denisovans around 800,000 years ago, with the bulk of them being closer to the 800,000 years ago. Now, it does seem there's been some others prior to that, and there's a few afterwards. It doesn't completely stop then, but the vast majority, I think it's a very small percent. I think it was certainly less than 10%. There's a small percent that have occurred since then, you know, in our modern human lineage. And also in these areas that have been changed, they continue to have faster than average mutations. So those spots that, you know, give us our unique brain structure are still rapidly changing. You know, once they've been modified, they go on to carry on in an accelerated, you know, evolution. So this isn't a process that just stopped, you know, after any interference happened. You know, we've still got areas that are throwing out curveballs. And in fact, they give us some of the, what we think of as non-typical neurology, you know, and maybe the spectrum of like Asperger's and all of these non-typical brain structures, right? These are related to those areas. So it's throwing out different kinds of brain structures as well.
About 12,000 BC, there was an extraordinary upheaval on this planet. It may have been Dr. Robert Schock, who comes on this show, feels that the planet was, the entire solar system with it, was moving through a dirty area of space, and it was being, the planet and all the planets were being bombarded by comets and other debris. It was also hitting the sun and exciting a great deal of solar activity. And this lasted about 1,000 years, at the end of which the planet was completely changed. The ice age was over, and we were responding as a species in very strange ways, such as the building of the Göbekli Tepe formations over a 1,000-year period, and then the burying of them over another 1,000-year period by people who had much longer memories and a much different worldview than we do. We could not be involved in a project, in a architectural project that lasted 2,000 years. But they did it. What? Is there anything that could have been coming in from the outside in that period?
Yes. I mean, when I look at Göbekli Tepe, and I've done some research in that area, you know, I'm also, I suppose you might think, classically an ancient mysteries researcher. You know, I've always had a fascination in that area. That what we see there, and this is quite incredible, actually, there's links between Göbekli Tepe, the artwork there and the symbolism, and the cultures down on northern Australia, particularly the area right on the coast of northern Australia, that you find some of the symbolism overlap. So from that, I've been able to interpret parts of the story. You may know that Göbekli Tepe is covered in serpent iconography, particularly. It's the most common theme there. Now, the serpent in Australia is associated with, you know, the rainbow serpent, and there's two, a male and female, and there's an association with water, with destructions, floods, you know, which are all of the things that, right, are happening at the time of the transition in the Younger Dryas, right?
Yes. So
my interpretation is I think that what we have is a kind of a project that was, it was done to almost to appease this chaotic force of the serpent, which is flooding their lands, destroying their world. And we also noticed there's only one image that's female. So it's almost as if they've eradicated the feminine serpent from this story that, you know, perhaps has been blamed for this, because you only have one piece of iconography there so far they found, which is female. And isn't this interesting? This is almost marking the time when we move into a patriarchal society, that somehow the feminine has been blamed for this, and is this one bit of graffiti only that points to the feminine serpent. So I think that we have almost like a machine, you know, in their minds, a spiritual machine is tackling this disaster. But we can also look at the serpent as possibly being a representation of comets as well. So I mean, this idea that serpents in the sky, and I know that we've had some iconography there that's been decoded as suggesting that there was also a cometary event underway at the time. So I think we have different themes, you know, that emerging into a singular site. But I don't think it's just about the comet. I think, yeah, there's a lot of this to do with this, an older view of the serpent and the creative and destructive power of the serpent.
Well, of course, the serpent in the Temple of Unas, the Pyramid of Unas in Egypt, which is contains our oldest religious text, which is the pyramid text, the serpent is prominently described as the core of the body, which connects the physical body to its lowest level of non-physical presence. Mm-hmm. And so the serpent was not only in the sky, but it was also in us in those days, as they thought, because that text in the Pyramid of Unas is so highly developed, the story must come from an even deeper time.
Absolutely. And another thing as well, with the Göbekli Tepe areas, we have legends of teachers teaching farming. And we know that farming, the transition to farming happens in, you know, in the Mesopotamian region. And there's legends there of teachers, you know, that give these skills of farming and language. And again, you know, it's unclear, you know, are these visitors, you know, are these spirits, or are they, you know, remnants of a lost civilization? I suppose that's where there's not clarity there. I mean, those could be, of course, you know, non-human visitors teaching us, but they could be remnants of the lost civilization. So I suppose it's hard to tell the difference. All we know, somebody there has an advanced knowledge, you know, which they're handing on to the survivors.
Free Dreamlanders, speaking of teachings, listen up and you will be taught, and you will agree to do whatever your teachers tell you. We'll be right back. As always, Dreamland's theme music is The O of Pleasure from Ray Lynch's beautiful album, Deep Breakfast, available at raylynch.com. This is just a quick reminder that the unknowncountry.com store is now open. You can enter it by going to unknowncountry.com and clicking on the store tab. You'll find all of my available books and much more. This is just a quick reminder that the unknowncountry.com store is now open. You can enter it by going to unknowncountry.com and clicking on the store tab. You'll find all of my available books and much more. We're talking to Bruce Fenton and Daniela Fenton, Exogenesis, Human Hybridization, The Sentient Mothership and Her Tears of Glass. Okay, guys, what in the world is this? What is the mothership?
Yeah, I mean, this is, we're getting to, I suppose, some of the I suppose, hard for anyone to immediately grasp without going into a lot of information. But what we got from the source information, and now the source information is a transmission from an artifact, which I believe to be left by non-human visitors, that the information it has passed on includes a description of a craft that is vast in size, that arrives here, is in orbit around the planet, is composed of largely of silica. In fact, there's a description that this craft was grown. It wasn't built in the way that we think of spacecrafts. It's described as having been grown in a crystal matrix and is inhabited by a consciousness. You know, it's almost like what we'd think of, I suppose, as sentient AI. And that this craft explodes in orbit around our planet, showering down this crystalline debris. Now, of course, I thought at first that, well, first, if this is real, You know, how do you prove it? And also, it being hundreds of thousands of years ago, what are the chances of finding any evidence, you know, even if something is real? You know, when we deal with these vast scales of time, often it's very hard to track down anything. So when I launched into this research, this was one of the key areas, was could I detect evidence of this purported craft and this visitation? I was actually quite shocked, to be fair, when I looked into the, you know, the geological papers and all the rest of that, and found that there's a 100-year-long mystery in science to do with a material called Australite tektite, which is nearly 80% silica. And it turns out it's rained down across about 20% of the Earth's surface from Antarctica up to Southeast Asia, right? So I'm looking at it, and I'm looking at the description of this, you know, it's a molted crystal rained down from this craft. And you find that there's this largely, you know, melted quartz silica material strewn all across Australia, Southeast Asia, Antarctica, and find out that nobody's able to explain it because of the specifics of this. And I'll just say that we've got objects that formed in space, small spheres of material that were made from, you know, molten quartz and other compounds, titanium, aluminium, that have formed in space, and they've captured bubbles of hard vacuum. And this is why the scientists kind of know that they had to form in space. And then they've come in at a shallow orbit, melting again and forming these shield shapes or button shapes called Australite tektite buttons. And so they know that it had to have been a space-based event. Now, this has led to the problem of, well, how could this be? You know, because they're expecting it to be an impact, but then how could you throw the material into space? And then another argument was that it came from the moon, but then the composition wasn't lunar crust. And so this is why this debate has raged on for 100 years. But if you factor in this craft that's described in this information, suddenly all of the anomalies are resolved. And that's one of the things that for me was astonishing, because, of course, if you have a theory that resolves all the anomalies, normally that's the one that's accepted. But of course, when you're dealing with the alien topic, it's the one that's never accepted.
No theory will work. No yeah. matter how, I mean, if they were standing across the street, the theory would be there's something wrong with my eyes.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. It'd be holograms, or it would be you've gone mad, or, you know, there's always another explanation. As the saying goes, it's never aliens.
Right. Never. Okay. But anyway, but go ahead. This thing explodes. Do you think it was intentional that it exploded?
Yeah, it's described that in fact that there's many different players in our cosmos, and that it's not a simple story that we just have, you know, one class of entity visiting us. And in fact, the information goes into the fact that we have multidimensional entities involved. We have silicon life forms involved. You know, there's different classes of biological entities that, you know, work with each other, and that this mission to Earth involves a number of different types of entities, as well as there being another group already here, who some of which are more hostile. And there's a sort of an ambush, a confrontation, a failed negotiation, which leads to this ship being destroyed in space. So it's a complex scenario. Much as I'd love it to be that, you know, that it was one of these simple stories, it's not. And again, it points to the fact that the cosmos, you know, as above, so below, that the cosmos, there is also at times there has been turmoil, you know, and there's been warfare and disagreements, and that these things have happened. And that's what it points to. So there is a deliberate event. But on a cosmic level, and this is explained, it says that there's entities that are, you know, well beyond us, you know, non-physical entities, who see this also as being positive. Now, at first, it might sound a bit crazy saying, how can it be positive? You know, this mission to Earth that's peaceful is destroyed. But they said, well, actually, it means that, firstly, that one day there will be traces of this mission found, which will be very exciting for human beings to discover. And they secondly say also, it means all the souls of these beings will now be included into the reincarnational cycle of our planet. And they see this as being a very beneficial event, even though on the face of it, it seems to be negative. So again, it's not human thinking, a lot of this stuff.
Let's talk about some of the evidence. Let's talk about Australite, for example. Specifically, the flanged buttons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these buttons that are rained down very specifically across the southern part of Australia. And so, you know, you're talking literally small pieces that are around the size, you know, of a coat button or something, not large chunks. And they start off as being a sphere. And then if you can imagine, if they come down at a very shallow angle, instead of burning up, as does most, you know, small particles, if they come in at a shallow enough angle, i.e. a decaying orbit, what happens instead is just the front edge melts and runs back. And so you end up with these kind of these little concaved shapes. And NASA studies into them many years ago noted that they had to be formed by these aerodynamic forces. In fact, they were very similar to the nose cones on reentry crafts. And this is why they kind of, you know, had an interest in them. And so they came to the conclusion the only way that these can form is if you have a large object in orbit that comes apart, you know, is superheated in some way, and that these smaller pieces then come in, having cooled in the vacuum of space, then come in, melt again, and have rained down specifically over southern Australia. Now, you also find some of this material elsewhere, but not these buttons. These are uniquely found across southern Australia. Down in Antarctica and up in the north of Australia, you find dumbbell shapes, teardrop shapes and stuff. And those are more associated with aerial bursts. And so what we understand happened is larger chunks of the debris broke the atmosphere further along that decaying path. And as they came in, those exploded almost like nuclear bombs and showered areas of australite, but in a different form. The tektite buttons can only form from entry from space. And that's been one of the key parts to why this has been a 100-year-long mystery, because they can't unravel how this could have been coming from space.
You're right. The composition of individual australite fragments ranges, but they are often up to 80% silica derived from melted quartz crystal. This is astonishing, as quartz crystal would never naturally compose the bulk of an asteroid, comet, or meteorite. From what I was able to find, it seems that silica is distributed in space, but quartz crystal rarely forms beyond planetary environments. For the sake of useful comparison, our own planet's crust contains approximately 12% silica crystal. Surely then, a lump of quartz crystal about 1/2 mile in diameter is mind-bogglingly unlikely.
Absolutely, yes.
So why, and even with, why don't scientists recognize this, or do they?
No, they don't seem to. And I think, that, in fact, all of the focus has been on looking for craters or arguing about whether it could have been moon rock. But nobody seems to tackle this thing that we have an entirely anomalous object, because it's, as you say, it's composed of nearly 80% silica. And so far, no other object, you know, asteroids, comets, any other bodies, has been found to have anything above 60%, right? So this is totally unprecedented. And then we have the fact that it's in orbit. And I looked into this, and astronomers basically say that large bodies cannot be captured by Earth's gravity. You know, it can happen with Jupiter and stuff, but we're too, you know, we haven't got enough mass. So what happens usually is they either accelerate past us or they slam into us. So the idea of one being in orbit and then breaking up, again, is astonishing. And I did try reaching out to, you know, astronomers and to NASA scientists, you know, to say, you know, isn't this a techno signature? Because they keep saying they're doing this new hunt for alien techno signatures. So what isn't a huge silica object in orbit around our planet? Wouldn't that have been, you know, a clear possible techno signature? But I've just had silence, really. So it's, you know, you can't even ask them why they don't look at it.
Well, of course, you do get silence from the scientific community, because they're in danger, just as if they were bishops in 1420 answering the questions of a heretic, scientists in 2020 answering the questions of somebody who is outside of their envelope of belief are in danger of destruction of their careers. In 1420, it was perhaps a little worse. They could have been burned to death. But in 2020, they could end up out on the street, or in any case, humiliated and unable to advance their careers. So it's a religious response, essentially. Now, this is this situation, whatever it was that happened, what effect did it have on us, do you think?
Yeah, I think that we have gone from being, in direct, normal, natural communion with the natural forces of our planet in the way that other animals are, that, you know, it has caused some kind of aberration in that. And again, we see that reflected today in the way we treat our ecosystems. Now, I think that has come out of this sense of being not quite a normal terrestrial organism, you know, that in some subconscious or, you know, spiritual way, that we feel that difference from the other animals, that we have been, if you like, unduly changed to a point where we don't feel entirely at harmony with our planet and probably have to make more of a conscious effort to stay in a natural order of things.
But, you know, the human species is not a natural order of things at all. As you point out, the only three types of human, types of primate, Neanderthals, Denisovians, and us, have 48 chromosomes as 24 associated pairs. We're different from everybody else. And it's as if somebody experimented three times, and the third experiment took. And here we are. So this is a fascinating journey. Exogenesis, human hybrids, a scientific history of extraterrestrial and genetic manipulation by Bruce Fenton and Daniela Fenton and Free Dreamlanders. I am leading to that sad moment when I have to tell you the next half hour, we are going to be talking to Daniela about what this all means now to people who are actually being affected by it, because she is a big-time close encounter witness whose life has been profoundly changed by her experience. In other words, we are talking to somebody who is directly affected by the manipulation that is going on right now, as I'm sure am I. Free Dreamlanders, thank you so much for being with us, and consider subscribing. Contact is happening. It's happening right now, and it's happening on unknowncountry.com.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by unknowncountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.